So I thought we'd get started and just talk to you a little bit. So I just mentioned, so I'm the Senior Service Manager for Link within Microsoft IT. Excuse me, we have three service managers, one that focuses on conferencing, myself, conferencing and collaboration technologies, everything from video to the client. We've got one that focuses on core and infrastructure and the client, and then another that is specifically dedicated around EV and audio quality. So my specialty is around, or focus is around the conferencing as well as video environments. Just to give you a little background, I came to Microsoft 2.5 years ago to help align their video strategy. They suffered what a lot of companies did, which is they had an old legacy video environment, they had a whole bunch of these different islands, and then they had Link. And so I was brought on almost 3 years ago specifically to help align that and really run their conferencing pieces. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about how we deployed Link, talk a little bit about our you were talking about topology, a little bit about how we've built out our environments, as well as I'm going to tell you a couple of stories of really kind of that'll set the stage as well for how things have worked for us and not worked for us. And then I'm also going to talk a little bit about what it's like to run Link and some of the pieces at Microsoft we focus on. And then also I'll talk a little bit beyond the desktop, right? You're seeing everybody out here with new devices and Link Room systems, and we just watched Derek Burney do a demo of what, 9 different modes of possibly connecting to Link. So talk a little bit about that. If you're looking for seats, there's some up front and some over here. So how Microsoft deployed, or Microsoft IT deployed Link, I thought I'd start off by giving you just a quick snapshot into our environment. So you take a look at this, just to give you an idea of our scale. Microsoft at any given time has 165,000 active users in Link on a monthly basis. Okay? We have 108,000 of those enterprise voice enabled. But that's our Link environment. What I'd like to call up is really our actual physical environment. We're in 107 countries. We have 568 buildings. Just Redmond alone has, the Redmond Puget Sound area has 92 buildings. We've got 8 data centers, and we have over 4,300 ITFTs. That's to run every part of our scale of our environment. So everything from our network to the line of business apps to everything else. One of the big pieces I wanted to call out here is also our federations. So we have over 10,500 federated companies. This is partners. This is customers. And what this allows us to do is really utilize Link as that go-to communication tool. So I own the devices program as well. So I work with Plantronics and Jabra and Sennheiser and Polycom and all of these other partners that really, when I want to have a conversation with them, I don't call them on their mobile, I don't call them on their landline, but rather I start a call via Link. And so this 10,500 companies is growing at such a rate because we reach out to our customers that way. It's almost like that central hub for communication. One of the ones that stands out where you talk about people and how they use the tool and how they use Microsoft, we see a 20% growth year-over-year in conferencing, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But as we see that growth, we're seeing 89% of those meetings internally are using app share or desktop share. So at Microsoft, meetings are part of our culture. I don't know what it's like at your company. So at ours, if you kind of a side story is when I first started at Microsoft, I got my calendar and I started to get invites. And I said, oh, I don't have that many. And all of my colleagues, were basically in meetings from 8 to 5. And I didn't understand. And he said, oh, just wait. And within 3 days, I had my entire calendar full, and they were double and triple stacked in multiple locations. Because it's a lot of how Microsoft's culture works. And so having a tool that's centric around meetings really created a lot of adoption that we're going to talk about in a second. One of the other ones that's kind of interesting is the number of unique active Link mobile users we have. We lit it up in August around the globe. And we have over 59,000 active Link users on a monthly basis in Link Mobile. Let's talk a little bit about our Link deployment and our overview of where we are. So we actually, I'll talk a little bit about our topology where we were talking and our breakout specifically, is we've got four data centers. We have two in the Americas. One is based in Tukwila, which is where the Seattle-Tacoma Airport is, just above it. And the other one's Quincy, which is actually in central Washington. These give us the ability to have our Americas-based users, so North America, South America, Central America, diversified across multiple data centers. And the reason that we did this was so that we could make sure that each of our environments created a redundant environment within itself. So we run two pools in each data center, and we run them at about 50% capacity, so we have failover capability. And if you take a look at the Americas has the exact same thing, as well as Singapore and Dublin. I'm going to share a quick story for you of why this worked out to our benefit. And when you start thinking about capacity, why understanding what your possible scenarios you're going to be in are. So how many people here have redundant circuits going into their data center and think that that's a great, that they're pretty safe in that environment? Most people have two circuits going into a data center. They feel redundant. Well, ours in Dublin was not only redundant, but had divergent paths through each side of Ireland to come out of our Dublin data center. Within 3 days, the first one was cut by a trawler, and then the second one, which was our failover, was cut by some form of construction equipment. So we are now dead in the water for all of our EMEA users. 31,000 users in EMEA were dead. But because we had the capacity, we did a force move of those users and moved them to Quincy. Now, when we were running this, we're like, oh man, we've got all of Europe running back to the US. We're gonna start seeing latency issues. We're gonna see users having issues. And what we identified was our service was the first one up, and people didn't have problems with those, with the latency. We didn't get escalations. We almost thought that it was theirs was still broken because we weren't getting any complaints. So just to give you a little bit more of that breakdown, so we have 156 of our sites are enabled for enterprise voice. And you'll see that 92% of Microsoft employees are EV enabled. And this one is actually, will go up because our biggest contingent was India. And we're now at the capability that, that India has said that we can actually have Link Enterprise Voice in country. So we'll see that number. There's a huge effort for us to go forward with EV in India because that is one of our largest campuses outside of Redmond. There's over 5,000 people in that location. Three major buildings, kind of modeled after Redmond. So, but going back, one of the pieces for us that just kind of gives you an idea of that scale is how many daily logins. So we have 500,000 daily logins, which means people are carrying more and more devices. At one point, just using Exchange as an example, we had 1.2 to 1.3 logins or devices per user. We're now at 2.9. Okay. Every single person in this room has at least one device in their bag, possibly two, and in some cases, three, that are connecting to the network, either through connecting either to Link Mobile or from my desktop app. So one of the big questions people ask is, well, when Microsoft deployed Link, what was the value for deploying it? And we had two. We had one, which was productivity. Okay. Our first one within productivity was We did a big analysis, you know, one of the ones where, you know, the consultants come out and they tell you how much you're going to save and they after the fact. And what we actually identified was it, we said that we saved 28 minutes per day. It was actually around 95 minutes per day. But what we realized is that people would actually only use that gain of about 28 minutes a day for themselves or to do work. The rest of it they would take into their own lives because it was more effective, more efficient. But the one for us that we saw was the increase in productivity. And we don't give the dollar figures around travel saved, but more the fact that people weren't commuting to the airport. They weren't spending it in a hotel. They weren't spending it at the airport. But we saw that productivity increase right off the bat. And then obviously the sales cycles, it's shortened because I could now get a team together without having to drive multiple locations. I could have somebody on the road join the meeting and we could be sharing the deck. A great example of this was I was in Paris and with one of our partners, and they needed to reach back to Redmond to talk to somebody in Redmond and somebody in India for a sales presentation. And they needed to be able to bring SMEs in from every single location. They brought them in all over video. They had their deck up. And then when they took a break, the users, the core account team literally broke off into a separate side meeting and refined the deck, came back, and was able to deliver a proposal within one call rather than flying people from Redmond, London, Paris, whatever. But the big one is really, what are the hard costs you saved? So I'm going to tell you a story here, and then you're going to see a graph in a second. But the big return on investment for us was audio conferencing. So our audio conferencing was about $15 million a year. So in our first year, we saved $8 million conservatively. One of the things that I don't know if you saw on that very first slide that we were showing was we talked about how we have had 20% growth in conferencing year over year. Well, we moved back in OCSR2, and then when we moved to Link, was when we moved to Link 2010, was when we got rid of the Verizon conferencing, and you'll see in a second. And what you saw was you saw such a steep curve, and the way that we did it, I'll talk about in a second, but was we used the carrot and then the stick model. And so what we did is we enticed users to use Click to Join, use Link. And eventually we realized people weren't migrating fast enough. And so what we decided to do was we went back to the business and said, hey, guess what? You can either use Link for free and use our conferencing platform for free, or we're going to start charging you back for that $15 million that you're using. And that $15 million was only the US IT spend. That didn't include any of our subsidiaries' IT spend for their own conferencing bridges. So, you'll see in a second, very huge transitional curve. One of the big ones here that I like to call out is where we talk about the reduced infrastructure and administrative costs. In 1 year, Microsoft will do about 70, in 2010, we did 75,000 office moves. And at $22 a move ad change, it had added up to about $1.6 million. That was an instant savings that we saw just in the first year and has paid off every year since. And then obviously the reduced infrastructure spend. You know, at one point, and I don't have the specific number, but we actually had, we had 21,000 trunks coming into our Redmond campus at one point. That's a huge infrastructure for just data center capacity for those PBXs, regardless of what we saved for the hard cost. So let's talk about where I like to talk about user adoption, okay? So when we were having the conversation before and I brought up what's the most important thing in any Link deployment, and I said that it was users, is because without your users adopting your tool and without understanding how they're using it, you're never going to be able to improve their experience. You're never going to get them to rely on it. If you went and it was too hard to start a car when you went to the car dealership, chances are you're probably not going to get the car. So we needed to make it easy. And what we saw was we saw the natural curve for instant messaging, right? It was a natural progression. FY is our fiscal year. So in 08, 09, IM and presence was pretty prevalent, the ability to use instant messaging. And then we saw the same native organic growth, and we're still seeing it within the one-to-one audio and video calls in a peer-to-peer sense. Instead of people walking down the hall, they're using Link to enable themselves for those scenarios. But one of the big pieces was here. Remember I was talking about where we used the carrot and the stick? Well, at this point, we'd had natural growth. And from right here, right about here, is where the click-to-join functionality, because we deployed Link 2010 in this time frame right about here, because one of the challenges with Microsoft, or one of the advantages of Microsoft, yet challenges, is we dog food. So we start our cycle long before you get it. So we get to be your IT department, so to speak, to really test the Link environment before it actually goes out to the real world. And we get to give the product group that feedback of, hey, these features are working. These are some of the challenges that we're seeing, so that when they go to market, they've got that great feedback. And we call it first and best, where Microsoft is the first and best customer of our own software. But at this point, we went to the business and said, hey, you need to move to this. You need to move to Link, or we're going to charge you. We literally saw a reduction in the Verizon, $8 million that first year, and now I think we're around $200,000 a year because we can't convince the last people to get off of it. But at one point, it was over $15 million. So I did have a quick question here, and that was, just as we're looking at users, we're looking at one-on-one, is how many devices do you think that the average user will have Link installed on in your environment in the next 2 years? And I'm going to give a hands. So one device, two devices, three devices, four, five, six, seven, eight. Okay, so five plus. So really, we're looking at three and four devices that people are going to have. And so one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about is one of the challenges that we face when we're now dealing with four different environments. And so I'm going to talk about how we run Link from a service management standpoint at Microsoft. And one of the pieces that I want you to think about is the things you can control, the things you can't control, and then the things that you can influence. So in the first one that I want to talk about is infrastructure. So we talk about topology, you talk about your network, you talk about DNS, you talk about your server environment. This is a very controlled environment. Okay? There's typically very tight change control processes involved in any of these environments. Okay? Change management is, and change control is very tight in this. Monitoring is very rich. But when you get into that environment, you can control this. But now one of the things that you have to consider is, okay, now I go to something that I can control a little less, which is that client. We just talked about four installs. And my guess is, from every company here, other than maybe providing a mobile phone, you only manage one of those devices. Maybe two. So you're now getting into an environment where you have to consider things like client version control. You have to understand their install method. Are you going to go down a click-to-run path, or are you going to use MSI? And with that, what does that mean for your users? Like, internally at Microsoft, we've got both environments. We've got users that install off of MSI, but the majority of our users are on click-to-run. Well, this poses a fun but yet interesting challenge, and that is that the day that those bits are launched to Office 365, all of our users are prompted for the update because we actually run off of our first and best product. So we don't bring it into our own click-to-run server. We actually use it off the Office 365 portal. But you also, at that point, are now going to have to start to influence your users' experience on their own devices. You're going to have, how many people here have to take escalations? How many people here don't want to take escalations? Okay? You're going to see that these four buckets that I'm about to give you, they all fall into one of these four areas. Okay? The next is device. We're talking about this. Is it managed? Is it an unmanaged device? Okay. Is it a standard PC where you know that the drivers and that everything that's on that machine is golden? and that they've got it plugged into the corporate network? Or are you have somebody running around with a Mac that's running beta on their own personal device that's connecting to your Link environment? Because at Microsoft, we enable every single user for every feature of Link. So voice, app sharing, meetings, the whole bit. The only thing that we don't is enterprise voice. And the only reason we don't is in certain locations, there's an atrophy level, right? Where, you know, really small offices, we just don't light up as an EV site. But on the same point to that, all of our users have full access to all the tools. Some of our customers that we talk to in showcases are like, yeah, we only let them use IAM in presence. Or, you know, we don't allow for a video on our network. Well, you're now in the device space where people are going to expect to have that functionality. We can all thank Skype for making our lives a little more painful because they expect to be able to click and get video and click and have audio just from their list. But at the same point, we also then have to take into account my personal favorite. The only thing I can do is influence these people. I can't control them in any form or fashion. Because in my environment, we need to explain that there's best practices. And if you talk to my director, and he'll say, we don't need people to have best practices. We need to have the product that's resilient. Yet, there's some things that we can't control. We can't control the internet. No matter how much we want to, we can't control the internet. I actually have a question. What do you think the percentage at Microsoft, and whoever gets this right, gets a Skype card. What the percentage of calls are at Microsoft are still over laptop speakers and mics, even though every single user knows that they should be using a headset? 30, 40? Who gave me 30? Okay, so 32% of all calls at Microsoft are... 32% of all calls at Microsoft are over wireless speakers and mics. Now, what do you think the poor call percentage of those is? Actually, so that's the interesting question, and that's why I asked this, because you know what? If I look at QoE and I look at my network, somebody could be plugged in and could be bulletproof on a call. But if you talk to somebody on the far end, how did that call go? Laptop speakers and mics are the worst. So actually, it comes out to about 60% of those, because typically people that are using laptop speakers and mics are also using wireless, walking down with a big flip phone. So when you come back to the four elements and you're having to go back and you're getting that escalation and you're having to talk to users, my first one is you have to rule out each piece of this. Was it user-facing? Where we talk about work smart sessions, one thing Microsoft does, some people call them brown bags, some people call them lunch and learns. We actually have a formal program called Work Smart where we actually do the best practices, and we'll actually go out to the field sites, we'll do it locally, we'll have it available on our internal IT web site for people to be able to access. One of the other things that I'm so grateful this year that we got was pre-call diagnostics. Came back to Windows 8. Anybody that remembers OCSR 2, we loved it because we had the capability to identify or put the bullet in the user's hands to find out if they really wanted to trash a call. And so one of the things that was nice is it came back this year, and we've actually used it to help us identify key problem areas that are either wireless areas that are challenging, setting up users. I'm going to show you something in a couple of slides that we actually designed based off of information we got back from pre-call diagnostics, the old one, just to really kind of give you some insight to that. But one of the things I want to share with you is that we're IT. And even though we're Microsoft and we're IT, we still have to report up. We still have to talk about what are our big rocks we're going after. We don't have unlimited funds. We have the same budget constraints that every IT department has, sometimes even more so, because we have to make sure that we're that first and best customer. So we got to deal with dog food clients before they go RTM. But at the same point, we have to have, this is what we call, we created this actually for our CIO because he had asked for, I want a single slide to tell me what your priorities are that you're working on and what those are driving and what the current states are. So we actually did this back in October or November, and it's still very true today. But what we did is we used the top one, which is those initiatives, and those are the things that are the big rocks we're going after. Customer intimacy, enabling those user experiences, right? We want people to be able to access Link from where they are, but then also, we're that first and best. But at the same point, we want to, at the same time, improve productivity. If somebody downloads a brand new client and they can't join a meeting, that doesn't improve productivity. So we have to weigh and balance those things internally. And then this scorecard gives us an ability to have our big rocks that we go after so that if we do get funding or we do are able to have those conversations, say, look, I need to be able to develop some additional resources for helping me doing advanced queries just based on our sheer size and scale. Our QoE database is massive, to say the least. Somewhere in the range of like 27 million records a day. But part of this was also the second piece. And I don't want you to get caught up on the colors, because everybody gets caught up on the colors. But what I want to talk to you about is these are the things that we know are coming every day. And we know that we've got Link Mobile. Link Mobile lands, and then I happen to see that I've got 59,000 active users in under a month and a half on a client that I can't provide QoS, that's probably running over broadband, but that is letting people now be mobile, and they're able to join meetings. And we just saw, and I didn't even know that, that you're able to use the speak to say, hey, join my current meeting. And Microsoft, I don't know if that works, because typically we have multiple meetings at the same hour. But then WPA, and I don't know, how many people here have open workspace environments? Okay. It's a newer concept at Microsoft. We've always had our office. We're very proud of our office. We've moved to these workplace advantage, as we call them, open work areas, and it's created some challenges to our traditional wireless environments because our traditional signal telemetry has now been maximized by everybody getting up from their computer or from their desk, walking over to whatever conference room or focus room they want, having a meeting, and then coming back. And what we identified was that this was a real challenge, and so we're working with the wireless service management team to take a look at real-time data for these buildings because we've identified through those escalations we all love so much that it's impacting more than just the one or two users. It's a building-wide challenge. And so we're reevaluating and redesigning our wireless plans around that. Multi-view video. But what this really does is these yellow things here are things that we want to keep an eye on. These are the things that we monitor, we're watching in these spaces. Our big one is the multiple versions of the single client, right? You have click to run, some people choose to install. They're not forced, it's not an SCCM push where guess what, your app's just closed and forced you out. We've chosen not to do that and really try to do the more user-centric, which is let's use the carrot as long as we possibly can until the last possible thing. And we had some challenges with wireless N because we wanted to go faster, better, all those pieces, but it wasn't global. So we had some link challenges for us in that wireless end space, and so that was what we reported up. So this was really our kind of our I don't know, this is like our snapshot into what our daily, weekly, monthly priorities look like. So optimizing our corporate network, okay? I talked about capacity planning, and we're going to talk a little bit about prioritization here in QoS. If there was another thing that I would say on your corporate network is paramount next to your user is understanding your prioritization for your device or for your link service. So we actually, way back in the days of different voice systems, long before we ever got Link, had to really have a very frank conversation with networking, and they didn't want it. They're like, we don't want you eating up all of our bandwidth. And we're like, we need to quasi-enable this, or we're not going to succeed. So The first step we did is we actually went down and said, okay, all hardware, let's unify. Across the board, let's be standardized on our hardware in our network environment, in our wireless network. So this one's specifically to our network. So we actually went with all Cisco for all of our hardware controllers, and then we're Aruba for our wireless environment. But then there was QoS, okay? Now, the thing for me that I end up having to do more often than I want to is I have to explain to someone that's a field seller that's working from home that is trying to present to a very large customer at home over wireless at 5 o'clock at night on a Wednesday. And this is a true story. So I was actually talking to this field seller, and he was based in San Francisco. And so I used the analogy. I said, okay, would you expect at 5 o'clock at night to be able to get from Palo Alto to San Francisco in the 17 minutes it would take if you were at 3 in the morning? Would you expect that at 5? No. Well, that's how prioritization works when you're on your corporate network. You have an HOV lane. There's no one else in your lane. It's prioritized and you make it all the way down. The minute that you go home, the minute that you go to your home network and you're running over the public internet, you're now competing for all traffic, namely your kids when they fire up Skype or fire up their Xbox One or fire up YouTube. My son's big into Minecraft, and the YouTube videos for Minecraft videos is probably 80% of the traffic across my network right now. But then understanding also the wireless usage, internally and externally, how your users are connecting. You know, it goes back to that user behavior, and it's really difficult because the average lifespan on, and this is not a statistic that I can quote, but it's more from anecdotal of talking to people. The average lifespan or the average age of a household wireless router is between 2 and 4 years old. Because people don't ever expect to have to replace it. And they don't do anything when they bought it. So 2 or 4 years ago, there was no auto negotiation. So they pulled it out of the box, they shoved it into their house, and it's all on channel 6. Which for the technical people that understand, that means you're all sharing the same channel with all your neighbors. What that means for the non-technical is crappy calls. So the last piece for us was understanding our topology and understanding those behaviors. One of the big ones that I like to talk about, and I talk about capacity and I talk about edge, who here has been to Seattle? Okay. Who here lives in a place that actually gets snow on a regular basis? Okay, you're going to find this humorous. So in Seattle, if it snows, they shut down. And when I say snow, I'm from Toronto, so I know snow. This is not snow, we would refer to it as flurries. Okay? My son's school closed last week, a week ago Monday, because my region goes a little bit into the thing, because we had 1/4 inch of slush on the ground. When we get snow, it shuts down the city. Well, about 2 years ago, we had a big storm. It was a real storm, so we weren't expecting people to be able to get around. And instead of everybody taking the day off, which would typically happen when, you know, everybody gets a free snow day, at Microsoft, because we all love what we do, we all hopped on Link and decided to work remotely. So we joined. And you know what happened? We tipped the edge. Because we weren't expecting 65,000 users to decide all of a sudden they wanted to work from home. So we actually went back, pulled a service improvement plan around this, identified what our capacity plan was, and said, okay, we need to be able to take this into account. We need to make sure that what we're doing doesn't impact our users. So let's make sure we put a little bit more here. The same thing happened actually when the tsunami hit in Japan. Afterwards, they now do once a year what they call the work from home day. And it's basically a crisis plan day. And they basically identify, can they work from home? What are the impacts? Can they get to SharePoint, Exchange, Link, their business apps? But those are the types of things that we have to take into account when we start looking at user behavior and priorities. One of the other things that we have to do, though, is in IT, because we have such a large environment, we actually have to look at what we call, I call it the IT toolbox, link toolbox. These are our custom tools, third-party tools, and reporting and applications that we've gone and done. The one that we actually did, so this is going back to those anecdotes, because I like them. I like telling stories. Anybody that knows me knows I like telling stories. But we actually had just done a physical audit of every single networking device in all of the Microsoft environment to ensure that we had QoS on every single one. It was very exhaustive. It was hundreds of hours. It was extremely costly. It was global. And we had an escalation. And it was about a VP who had a call with a customer internal to Microsoft, and it had bad. Well, what ended up happening was, because of manual change processes, the QoS configuration, we had configuration drift on a device in that building, and so there wasn't QoS being passed. Well, what we did is our networking team, which was part of us at that time, actually went and deployed HPNA, which is basically a network analyzer that analyzes for policy enforcement for QoS. And every single morning, this spits out a report for us, and it sends to our networking team to say, okay, these are your devices that are out of compliance. Go fix them, basically. And when we first ran it, we found that because it had taken so long to do that, we had config drift across a whole bunch of devices just due to manual changes, human error, right? People process technology. So the other one that we did and we brought in as a third-party tool is actually the PowerSuite from Unify Square. And the reason we actually did this was the PowerMon tool gave us the ability to do real-time monitoring on our environment, on our link environment through PowerMon. And this gave us the ability to identify any of our gateways that were down, anything that was down from our conferencing. But really, the big piece for us was it gave us that telemetry into what our real-time availability was so that we could have our teams being a little bit more proactive and less user-centric reactive. What I mean by user-centric is we all know the user complains about something, then you go investigate. Let us be proactive that we start to see these alerts early on and that we can do it, we can fix it before it becomes a user-facing issue. But then we had to also then go do some custom reporting. We built out what we call our top 10 reports. Top 10 worst subnets, because we tie it to our IP database. What were our top 10 worst gateways for traffic based off of QoE and CDR? What were the top worst wireless subnets so that we can really start to go and trigger those? But one of the pieces we also did was working with the product group was actually to identify all the CDR diagnostic codes that were failing across and then trending those, so the top 10 for each one, and trend those from 1 week to the next. So what it gave us the ability to do was see, hey, you know what, I had, you know, 250 of this error last week, and I've got, you know, 750 this week of this error. What's going on? We can go and start to investigate before we start to hear some of that user noise. And then the other one was we actually built a tool internally called My Setup. And what it did is we actually parsed out the conferencing data to kind of enable our users to find out who trashed their call. So most of you, except those probably in the front row, can't read this. But this one here that says poor has mobile broadband. Well, the person that actually hosts this call is based out of Hong Kong and deals with people globally. So they connect from wherever they are, whenever they are. Well, he was trying to find out specifically why we could not hear this person that was right here and what was going on and why it was a poor call. And but what it ended up being was instead of thinking it was actually somebody that was on the call that was trashing it, he was able the next morning to go in, take a look at this information, identify who it was, have a conversation with that person to say, hey, don't do it. I need to, if you're going to present, you're going to be there, I need you to join in. I need you to join in from either landline or wireless from home or office. One of the pieces, though, that I realized we had to do these is because link is the canary in the coal mine. You want to know how robust and strong your network is? Light up link. You want to know if you have any DNS challenges? Light up link. You also have to understand that you've got multiple geographies. If you've got a multi-geography space, you have to understand that it's easy to figure out what's happening in the U.S. It's not easy to figure out what's going on in Kuala Lumpur or what the time frames that people are working. We're a global organization, so most people in our company at some point are on a call from home before or after hours because they're dealing with Asia or EMEA. So it also gave us the ability to have better indicators of health. It also allowed us to empower users. The big piece behind this one, though, that for me was kind of key, was it also meant that I could let IT managers in field locations have access to this report and look up their users. Without having to go and pull a huge QoE user activity report, they could at least get that very first snapshot of what the health of the call was. Yeah, it was. Talk to consulting. Consulting actually took it from us and is productizing it, so Microsoft Consulting. And the reason is that because it actually pulls unique data from your environment, it's not just something that pulls off of QA, right? So Microsoft Consulting Services, I know, is working with a couple of customers on it right now. Let's talk about best practices. It's near and dear to my heart. It's near and dear to my heart because I've always had more of the customer side of the thing. I would love to say that I'm really technical and I can dive deep. It's video conferencing, I'm there. I can go deep. When it starts dealing with link, I have a pretty detailed understanding, but I'm not going to remote PowerShell into the link server. So one of the big pieces that when it comes to those best practices is informing your users how to use devices and where and when to use them to be successful. And in a couple slides, I'm going to show you what we did for our leadership that really simplified how to explain what they should use when. But understanding the implications of wireless when they're external. 50% of all of my poor calls come from external wireless. Now, that's of all my calls, and the majority, and we're about 50-50 internal-external. We're actually about 48% of our calls are external, 52 are internal at Microsoft. When I say internal, I'm saying they're on our corporate network. Understanding what you're conferencing, are you a peer-to-peer, one-to-one type of company, or is conferencing a very major element within your user base? Because for us, people set up meetings for one-on-one syncs. People, as I was kind of telling you before, the meetings are part of our culture. And so our ability to have a conferencing platform that's easy to use is paramount. The one of the ones that I like to talk about here, we were actually in an EBC with a very large customer, and they don't do any standardization of their computers. They have a standardized image that's installed on the computer, but they don't push up driver updates. It's on the user's experience to do those updates, making sure they're getting the most current drivers. And so this is a huge one for companies that are looking at link, because you want to control everything you can possibly control or influence, right? And I can control the standardization of computers. My computer sits in my bag. I push GPO to it to say that Link is got quality of service. The Link app has quality of service. And I know that my physical network has quality of service across the LAN and the WAN. But I don't know that if somebody's using their little tablet device, right? Because I can't push anything to an unmanaged. So letting users know the importance of standardized devices and when to use what and how. A scenario around this was we had a user escalation customer. It was a customer-facing meeting with a very large automobile manufacturer. And when we went back to have the conversation, they were on their home computer over wireless presenting to a CIO. And it's helping your users understand what is important. And so these next two slides, I'm actually going to talk to you about things that we've done to help improve our user experience. So the first one was we created what we call our devices program. And our devices program was actually started before I was there, but really we defined it as three kind of tiers. So anybody can build a headset or a camera or a speakerphone. Heck, go on to Amazon, type in headphones. You'll see hundreds of them, right? But then there's the Link logo program or the qualified on for Link. And this helps us meet the Link functions, the audio quality specs, that it hits a bare minimum bar. So at Microsoft, to become an MSIT approved device, bare minimum bar is Link logo program. Because at that point, I know that if there's an issue with it and it goes to CSS, or I submit it for support, or I go back to the product group, that I can go back and say, hey, it is part of the qualified program. Now, some companies, that's not their requirement for logo programs. But the biggest piece is making sure that it is stable. It is going to provide you the environment you want. And I use this. This is great around headsets. And this, the second one's more around specifically around headsets for kind of give you the idea. But there's two elements. There's the objective and the subjective. The subjective comes to users. And I write social and cultural because I keep getting emails from women saying, can you give me more headsets that don't require me to put a headband over my hair? I get responses from people that say, look, I'm on the road all the time. I need something that's going to give me 8 hours of battery time and not require me to keep charging it when I get in the car. So it's also user behavior, I guess, is social, cultural, user behavior, but also is fidelity. Fidelity is one of those things that is objective, but from the perceived, it's subjective. Because if I feel that I'm not hearing the right feedback in my ear when I'm speaking, or if I feel that what somebody on the far end hears me speak, but they can hear background noise, that becomes a fidelity piece for them, that they set an expectation of what that device is. And so a lot of what we try to do is not duplicate those. What we try to do is also, construction and durability is huge for us, because our guys are running around all the time, especially now that we got WPA spaces. It's at their desk, it's in a focus room, it's in a conference room, and I can't have this thing breaking apart. So we actually built a program, and actually if somebody goes to our IT web page, there's every single device we have, wired, wireless, speakerphones, conferencing room devices, et cetera. So they have all the information they need to make an educated decision. They also have an alias, so they can reach out if they want more help. This is this one that we're going to, actually, I'm going to come back and I'm going to explain this. So this next slide that you're going to see is what I actually built for a senior level person within our company. And it was actually for meetings with our country managers. They're all around the world, and we were getting complaints that people were not joining the meeting properly. How many people here have gotten an escalation because somebody decided to join from Starbucks or a hotel lobby over their speaker and mics at the Link conference? So we built this, and what it was it was actually to build the experience of, okay, where am I and what should I use, right? What is the intention for my meeting and what is my environment? And the big one for me was I had a lot of users come to me and say that, hey, I'm at home and I want to just listen in on a call, and I want to be able to, you know, finish up cooking. Great. That's fine, because you're not participating. This is where you have participants, attendees, and presenters. A participant is somebody that's participating, and that's two-way. An attendee is typically somebody that's just absorbing the information. If you're attending it, great, listen in. If you're sitting off campus and you need to have a customer facing a meeting, or you're talking to your boss, you'd plug in. I use the example, 10 years ago, you would never expect to pick up your cell phone and have a Fidelity conversation driving down the road. But we expect that Link works flawlessly currently because the software exists, therefore the network infrastructure should exist around the world. And actually, when I told you when he came in, I was here, I originally started to build out our Link conferencing video environment. And my vision was video available in every meeting by 2016. And everybody asked me, well, why would you push it out to 2016? I said, because the software is there, but the hardware and the infrastructure isn't in place for everybody to be able to access a Link meeting over video successfully. So this was something that we built. The funniest story about this, though, was I built this for 20 people. It's now in 9 languages. It's around the country. It's used in presentations. It's used by IT managers, and it's used by actually admins that actually hand it to their bosses and say, look, these are some great practices. So when you start thinking about, when I said what's the most important thing, and I said thinking about the user, was a great example with this, because we actually saw that it made a difference in the meetings right off the bat. So let's talk a little bit about beyond the desktop. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is circle of influence. So your circle of influence right now is everybody that you engage with, friends, family, coworkers, right? But in the business world of Link and using Link and calling it its circle of influence, you really have to look at what Link does to bring people together. So in our environment, it brings our users together. It brings our facilities, that's RENF and MSAV, is Real Estate Facilities and Microsoft Audio Visual. Microsoft IT, and within IT, I could blow out the entire dependency map in that one to network, DNS, you know, service managers, service availability. Our device manufacturers, we just saw that list of the programs. So, you know, what does it mean to qualify? What does it mean for my conference room devices? Our product group, because we're at Microsoft, we get to engage with the product group. It's wonderful. It's wonderful because we get to have some influence into those challenges. It also has its challenges because for us, it means we've got stuff that's in that dog food state. It's before it's in beta. And so we get to see it in its raw state. And then global procurement. So our challenge is we're a global company. But it's also an opportunity because it means that my global procurement can say, hey, I want to be able to purchase this headset, but I have to be able to do it in 82% of my countries that we're in, or whatever their number is. And so he will work with the manufacturers to do that. And all of this is tied together via Link, because Link is a common thread in all of these spaces. People don't think about Link. They call it about unified communications, but the whole first word is that we're unified. We're all together. And so that's really what we had to do when I built the program around the devices program. This is actually was the byproduct, was that we now have work streams that go across RENF, product groups, IT, device manufacturers to make sure that we are, the OEMs, to make sure that we're all there and working well. But I wanted to talk about our newest growth area, because this one we talked about briefly, and just to give you an idea, yes, we're Microsoft. We don't use a lot of iOS and Android. But the number I was telling you about was we turned on services for EMEA and APJ around August 1. So remember, I was talking about our fiscal year? Well, we have a change freeze at the end of the year so they can, you know, finish their fiscal stuff. What we did is we actually lit up EMEA and APJ with that feature set in August, and we just shoot through the roof. And I went to go get updated numbers for November and December and just haven't gotten a chance to get to it. But it still continued to climb every single month. More and more people are using it. You watched Derek Burney this morning using it in so many different forms and fashions. it creates a new dimension to supporting Link. And so keeping this and monitoring it and watching it is very important for us. How many people here are thinking about Link Room systems? Okay. So we're Microsoft. Everybody's like, oh, you're Microsoft. You could just, you know, put Link Room systems in wherever, whenever you wanted. However, the big piece with us is when we put in Link Room systems, we have to, in essence, 10,000 conference rooms globally. We have over 500 offices in over 100 countries. It's not an easy task. And so what RENF and IT did is we sat down and we said, okay, let's look at all the options for Link Room systems. Let's look at all the options for conference rooms. And we actually went through our pilot. We built a proof of concept where we identified our provisioning and what remote management we could use. What our support structures were going to look like going into that global pilot. Because in the field, it's different than in Redmond. In Redmond, I've got a bunch of people running around. In the field, I might have a full-time IT manager. I might not. I might have a facilities manager in that location and a part-time IT manager. So we had to take a look at those different pieces because for us, it came down to these four pieces. It had to be manageable. It had to be efficient. It had to be able to be supported. But most importantly, I had to be able to measure that user experience. And so we spent the last 3 months really building out that this program in the global pilot. And we're now getting to the stance of what is our official rollout? What is our scale? Because we're an IT department. I don't have $30 million to go and upgrade all the conference rooms. So what is my priority list? How do we do that and what do we do it? And so as we went through this, our key was we started with that proof of concept. We identified what we needed to do to make sure that user experience was extremely stable. In our environment, one of the challenges that we found was that the receptionist books conference rooms in most of our buildings for users. They just book the room. Even though there's a Link meeting and they have a separate invite for a Link meeting, the receptionist books the conference room. Well, that means then that the ability to use Link Room system adds a little bit of complexity and another layer to it. So it took some user-facing components to it to us to really like be proactive with our users and send them an email before their meeting to say, hey, you're about to walk into a Link Room. You might want to take a look at this. Here's some videos on how to use the device. So that was really, from our Link Room system program, it was really, what is that programmatic so that we don't impact that productivity? Because that could have happened in a split second. Had I gone and put these in and not understood how users were going to do this, it was going to impact us. Going to video, which was a byproduct of, you know, when I started, we had five islands. And our five islands were, we had a Cisco telepresence suite, we had live meeting, we had Link. I had over 400 VTC endpoints, ranging back to ViewStation 128, that there are still a few out there. And I also had a Halo telepresence environment that was supported by HP. And I walked in and I said, okay, we can't have all these disparate islands. We need to build the bridges. And I didn't want to just build bridges. I wanted to build an environment. And so this was kind of our guiding document to really, I know this looks like a very technical document and a very technical Visio. There is a call flow document that goes to it. But the key was really we had been dealing with all of our video environments previously in the legacy world because that's where video lived. It lived in a 3-2-3 world. It lived not in the webcam centric. I have 175,000 users that all can use video from their desktop. I have 15 telepresence suites, and I now have 200 and change VTC units versus 170,000. And I remember the day I interviewed at Microsoft, got into a debate with the person, one of the people, about how amazing video and how we could change the wave. And we both shared this passion to the dismay of some of the other people on our team because we both loved video and how it could impact. But I had such a strong thought and understanding of the legacy environment that I didn't understand that Link at the desktop and then the next generation of what we were going to do in conference rooms was going to have such a prevalent impact. So one of the pieces we did is we ended up building our environment where we did two things. One, we gave our users the expectation of if you're hosting a telepresence meeting, you're in a telepresence meeting. It can be telepresence with VTC, you can do all that, and you can attend via link. If you're in a link conference, you're in a link conference. Let's focus on using that link environment. And so one of the big pieces we did was we rescaled our dial plan so that we could bring in anybody that was on standards-based video conference into any of our telepresence meetings or VTC, as well as any of our federated link conference users into that environment. But the majority of our video traffic is in our link environment. And I watched our link traffic and conferences go from 6% to 28% when we went to Link 2013. And it's the same statistics that the VTC world saw when they went from voice switch to continuous presence. Because when you can see multiple people, people feel that they're now accountable on video, they actually turn it on, and so that's what we looked at. Now, I wanted to give us 15 minutes to kind of wrap up, ask questions. I figure there's a few. But one of the slides I built a while back was called The Trip Ahead. And I built it at the end of our fiscal year, so around June, because these were the trends that we were starting to see. These are the things that I focus on every day. And if I'm not focusing on this, and I'm focusing on something else, I need to repoint myself around where these are. So I could spend, you know, a week just talking about this, but let's open it up. Yeah. And no hard questions, by the way. Zero. We don't do a virtual environment. Sir? You were going to...
Mm-hmm. What struck me was you hadn't got on there anything about a telephone call savings and also PBX maintenance savings.
I have a whole slide that actually gets into the value realized statement. Those are the ones that I specifically picked out. I can tell you that we've decommissioned 58 PBXs. I can also say there's been a great savings in that space. Obviously, we had 21,000 trunks. We don't now. We have much fewer coming in just into Redmond campus. We've moved all of our conferencing in North America to SIP trunking rather than PSTN. So, like through our gateways. Don't tell our gateway guys. So.
Trunks.
21,000 trunks. Yeah. Yes.